Welcome to this whole day all about the issue of virtues, values, ethics, and morality. And this session will be very different from the messages that you normally get. And the reason is because I'm going to make a very clear distinction between values, ethics, and morality on the one side, and virtues on the other side. I will refer you to a murli that I can't remember the date of, but you might remember it, when Baba said, your only problem, you only have one problem. Your only problem is that you are caught up in right and wrong. Do you remember that murli? It was an Avyak murli of some years ago. And then if you look at the murlis, sorry, there's my phone going, it'll stop in a minute. Have you ever seen in Baba's murlis that he ever mentioned anything about ethics, values, or morality? Have you? Any time? Anyone? But BKs are all the time talking about ethics, values, and morality, right? We have living values, we have value education, we have moral values all over the place, right? Did it come in any murli? No. So, you can see already a little bit of forensic, you know, detective activity. We see that there are some discrepancies between the things that God talks about and the things that humans talk about, because we are confluence-aged Brahmins. So that means that there are moments when we are totally into Srimad. Then there are other moments when we are body conscious, which means that we are into Parmat and Manmat. So, now, Srimat, as we all know, is whatever Baba says. But then Parmat, I just want to check, am I speaking okay for the translators, not too fast? Okay, good, thank you. Parmat, we hear this mentioned in the murlis as the directions of others, right? But there's a number of other ways that you can interpret that statement. And one of them is the attitude, mentality, and prevailing belief system of people. That's Parmat. And Manmat, because you hear about the prevailing social attitudes the moment you come out of your mother's womb, or maybe even earlier, it's your absorbed and internalized form of the directions of other people or the opinions of people in general. And then it becomes your own ideas, but it started out as other people's ideas. So Baba always tells us, follow Srimat, don't follow Parmat, don't follow Manmat. Now, what is the exact meaning of morality? The exact meaning of morality, if you go and check in some very hyper super duper dictionary, you will find that it says that it is the opinion of the ruling class in any group or community, which is designed to keep them in the ruling position, and which suits their convenience and their interests. So you can understand from that description that it's quite body conscious. Yeah? Now, what is the exact meaning of ethics? It's exactly the same thing as the exact meaning of morality. Why do we have two words, ethics and morality? You would think we have two words because they're two different things. Are they or are they not synonymous? Well, in terms of their actual meaning, they're synonymous. In terms of their use, we tend to have ethics for professional activities and morals for things that we do at home. Right? Otherwise, it's exactly the same thing. There's no difference. Now, ethics is a word that comes from the Greek ethikos, and morality comes from the Latin mores. And we even have an English word that you probably never heard of, which is mores. It's an English word, and it means the customs of the prevailing social group and traditions. So, as you know very well, human beings are heavily dedicated and loyal to the prevailing social attitudes and traditions. Is that right? There are very, very few people who think independently of those things. It's very, very difficult to find a person like that. When you come to Baba, you say, yes, this is right. Soul consciousness, go for it. God consciousness, Baba, Shri Baba, through Brahma Baba, Srimad, very good, yes. Right? That's why we're all sitting here. But then, you see, there is this problem called recidivism. Have you ever heard that word? It's a very good word, recidivism. Very few people know it. Baba usually uses it, he uses the word jailbirds in the Murali. You've heard when he says jailbirds, he means people who keep on committing the same crime and they keep going back to jail. And that is also called recidivism in a formal way. So what we BKs do is we go back to conventional morality again and again and again and again. And in our normal talking and our pamphlets that we write, you know, moral values. That's the same thing as spiritual virtues. Right? Yes? No? Yes, we do. But it's not. And I'm trying to, especially in this session and a lot of other things I do, I'm trying to make it clear to everybody that spiritual virtues originate in God. He is called the ocean of virtues, is that right? Have you ever heard God called the ocean of ethics? Or the ocean of values? Or the ocean of morals? Never, right? Of course, BKs are definitely the ocean of values, morals, and ethics. But what we want to be is similar oceans to Baba, because all these values, ethics, and morality, where do they originate from? Basically, they begin, if you trace back the history of ethics and morality and values, they begin around the beginning of the Iron Age. It's about, for the last 1,000 years, these things have been really set in stone and they have become the traditions worldwide. And when we come to Baba, we come from that background. And we are taught from the earliest age, from our parents, from our teachers, and from our religious leaders, that if you want to be a good whomever, a good girl, good boy, good British person, good Indian person, good American person, good Cambodian person, whatever it is, you follow these values, right? But they come from the Tamil Pradhan intellected people who were the ruling classes who controlled the governments, the religions, the media from that time until the present time. So you can see by this description that I'm giving you that because the origin is different, the two things are likely to be actually quite different. And so this is what this session is all about, because I'm going to do an experiment on you and see whether what I'm trying to say is actually able to get through. This may or may not happen, I don't know. Because, as I say, most BKs, they really do not make these distinctions at all. If you look at Dadi Janki, and you listen to her classes, she will mention values and that, but when she is describing something, she's talking about Srimat, she's talking about the virtues. Is that right? So, now, the aim of this session is not only to make these distinctions, but also to see if we collectively, individually and collectively, can give up morality. Can you do that? Oh. No, it's really important. Give up. I mean, let's put it this way. Let's put it another way. Let's give it some more epithets. We will say toxic conventional morality. Because morality covers a huge wide spectrum which people don't examine too much or analyze too much. But I do a lot. Now there are some attributes of morality that correspond exactly to spirituality, but there's not too many of them. And there's quite a lot of morality that is okay, take it or leave it, doesn't matter. But there is some which is actually really bad for you. So now you can see that if you mix up poison in water with a bit of sugar and drink that, you'll probably die. Right? If you have poison water without the sugar, you'll still die. And if you have poison, no water, no sugar, you'll still die. So whatever it is, you'll die. So what I'm trying to do here is extract the poisonous bits. And we don't need that much water. And let's just go for the real thing, the nectar. That's what I'm trying to do here. Does that make sense to you? Okay, that's great. So, now one of the things that we find in this world, in most societies, not everywhere, but in most parts of the world, because of morality, there is a lack of equality between males and females. And it's not because of any other reason than morality, ethics, and values. You see, because the value of a female in the workplace is about 40% less than the value of a male, which is reflected in her take-home pay. And the actual work that she does may even be more or better quality, but her value is less, and therefore her pay is less. So the pay is not determined by the work or the qualifications, but that a woman is fundamentally of lower value than a male in the market. You see? Is that right? Do you know about this? Yeah. So what is the origin of that? Ethics, values, and morality. When Sri Baba talks to us, he says, "Oh, my stars," right? He called the stars on the 15th, Sitare. You see. And now one of the things we know from Srimad is that all souls are genderless. Did you realize that? All souls are genderless. And then he says, "Yes, you're all my sons." Mite mite bache doesn't mean sweet, sweet children. It means actually sweet, sweet sons. Something new. He talks to us as sons across the board because in the conventional ethics and morality, another area where there's a discrepancy in many countries, not in all countries and cultures, but one discrepancy is, well, the sons will inherit, but the daughters won't, because they don't need money. They can kind of live on air. They can be breatharians, you know. That would be all right. You see? And so you see all of these disequilibriums is because of this idea of this gender differentiation. And there are other differentiations also that we see, which are created by conventional ethics, morality, and values. And that one of them is that the lighter the color of your skin, the more valuable you are. Have you heard about this one? Yeah. So if you have like super white skin, like if you're a Swede, for example, or an Icelandic person where there's hardly any sun, you have a very pale white skin, so that makes you really super valuable. And on the other hand, if you come from southern India or Africa and you have really black skin, then that's really not okay. You see? So this is one of the attributes of toxic conventional morality, which evaluates people on the basis of their pigmentation. What a strange thing to do. You think humans are civilized. But where does this idea come from originally? Do you know? It comes from the scriptures. It comes from the scriptures, not anywhere else. You see, and who wrote the scriptures? Definitely not God. Who wrote the scriptures? Well, some of us, you know. Not even Copper Age. Copper Age, they spoke, but they got seriously written down, you know, Iron Age. So what we are thinking of as the ancient traditions of the world, or the ancient civilization of India, goes back only 1,000 years. So my contention is that we, who are the ancient original ex-deities from India, we go back 5,000 years. Is that right? And so therefore, we go back way before the Copper Age. We go back to the Golden Age, and here we are now in the Confluence Age. And the Confluence Age is there, as you know, it's connected with the Trimurti, you know, Brahma, Vishnu, Shankar. And so Brahma, Vishnu, Shankar is all about, you know, creating something new, which comes from Shiv Baba, and then sustaining that, and then destroying something old, which comes from the Tamo Pradhan human society. Theek hai? So, I'm taking these things quite to heart and saying, okay, let's see, what does this imply for us in our practical day-to-day life? Because as far as I can tell, Sri Baba is asking us to become, once again, the ancient original, 16 celestial degrees complete, complete with all virtues, not a single value or moral or ethics required, only virtues, and completely non-violent, and etc. Deities, is that right? Is that why we're here? Are we trying to become this? So therefore, my contention is, most important thing, is we must give up ethics, morality, and values. And I'm going to give you 5 or 6 reasons why we really don't need those things. So, first reason why, let's just use the word conventional morality for all this. The first reason is that conventional morality is fundamentally punitive. You know, it goes like this. Bad BK. You know. And you can see, because you've got the third eye, you can see the most subtle and most invisible vices in the other BKs. Is that right? Very easily and clearly. Of course, we're supposed to be seeing their virtues, but we're so busy with morality that we go there, you see. So there's actually a misuse of the third eye, so we'd be careful of that, because that would become a sin, which you have to pay for. You don't need to pay for any more extra sins, we've got enough as it is. So one thing is it's punitive. Second reason is that it is biased against women, children, animals, the planet Earth, and people of darker skin color. So, that's not very spiritual, is it? So, second reason. Third reason is it causes people to develop double standards. One law for me, I'm okay. A different law for you, you're not okay. Double standards. Is that spiritual? I don't think so. But conventional values, morality, and ethics definitely causes people to develop double standards. And to make a tacit agreement. Tacit agreement is an agreement that you don't tell anybody about. But everybody knows, you know, that we people, we can do X, Y, Z, but the other people can't because they're inferior. Right? That's called double standards. And one of the wonderful things about living in a multinational, multicultural family, which we are, especially among the double foreigners, is a bit difficult to get away with that. People try, but it makes it much more difficult when you're multicultural, because people will notice, excuse me, which kind of we people are you talking about? You know? So, there's double standards. And the fourth thing is, it leads to corruption. It leads to corruption. Why does it lead to double standards and corruption? Is because morality, ethics, and values, you kind of write down a list of all the things that it should be, especially use the word should. You know, anywhere in any BK literature where you see the word should, cross it out. Should means it isn't. Should means you think it should be for them. But then if it comes to me, no, that doesn't apply to me. You see? So, and then how does it corrupt you? Is that it causes people to go into denial and to become dishonest, you see. So that's not very useful, is it? Right? So do you see where I'm coming from? And so, now, the reason I'm talking about all this is because my perception is, I may be wrong, but my perception is that nobody seems to have seen this problem. So I'm kind of trying to draw it to everybody's attention that it is a problem. In fact, I would say the only problem that we BKs have is that we still maintain our loyalty to toxic conventional morality. And what we need to do is give it up. Now, why are people unwilling to do that? I mean, that's the scariest thing to do, right? Give up morality, ethics, and values? Can you do that? Can you go home and say, oh, Mom, Dad, I've given up morality? I say, what? You see? Now, why is there such a thing as toxic conventional morality? Basically, you know, because God is not there, He comes, right? That means He's not there until He comes, then He is there. So because He's not there during the Copper Age and Iron Age, He's even not there in the Golden Age and Silver Age, but that doesn't seem to be a problem because we're, you know, still sustained by Baba's powers, knowledge, virtues, spiritual purity. In the Copper Age, we become body conscious. And as you know, body conscious people have an enormous amount of ego. Is that right? But body consciousness and ego is synonymous. And so these toxic conventional values are created by people with a lot of ego. For people with a lot of ego. About people with a lot of ego, in order to preserve and actually even increase the general amount of ego in the world. So they're very successful, very successful. But it leads to hell, so that's not so useful. So, well, you know, I'm your father, therefore, do not do what I do what I say. You've heard that one, right? You see? So I'm the boss, therefore what I say goes. I'm the chief doctor of the hospital, therefore my way or the highway. You see? And if you have a better way, we'll get rid of you because it doesn't look good for my reputation if somebody else is more clever than me. See what I'm saying? And so, of course, what Baba encourages us to have is humility. And one of the attributes of humility that he teaches us is that if I do have a speciality, a talent, a quality, a virtue, I cannot take credit for it because I know deep down that this was bestowed upon me by Baba. Is that right? You see? So that's humility. And when everybody says, oh, you're wonderful, marvelous, and fantastic, you say, oh, because Baba made me like that. But before He made me like that, you probably would not have thought that I was so wonderful, marvelous, and fantastic, you know? Because I wasn't. And so we are created by Baba. I did a lot of research among 10,000 people to find out if there is any discernible difference in the morals of people who are BKs and people who are not BKs. And I found there was a teeny tiny bit of difference, but it was definitely discernible. Because we'd meditate, and we listen to Murli, and we're trying to be nice people, and we're trying to not get angry and this and that. And so, you know, eventually after a few decades, you can see a difference. Not in everybody, but most of them. So I found there was a discernible difference. So you see that when God comes, which is 1937 or so, so for the last 79 years he has been going on at us about, you know, your souls, you're genderless, you're bodiless, you're eternal and immortal, you are my children, you have a right to the inheritance, would you please claim your rights, would you please absorb all of me into yourself, because I'm here only for a little while and then I'm going away. And whatever you absorb, that is going to have to handle your expenses for the next 5,000 years. Is that right? So you better absorb a lot, because you have an expensive lifestyle in the Golden Age. You need your private planes, you need your palaces, you got your servants, your thousands of acres of land, your cows, you know, and all your people. So it's expensive, so you need a lot of money. And you have to absorb that from the good karma and yoga that we do during the time of the confluence age, which is almost over. So Baba is the ocean of virtues. Is it right? So he pours himself into all of us, along with all of his knowledge, all of his light, all of his might, all of his everything. He pours it into us, and we receive it number-wise. But before he came, we had absolutely no choice but to agree to be moral, ethical, and with values, even though it makes us punitive, even though it creates double standards, even though it makes us corrupt, and even though it leads to hell. We had no choice. Because if we didn't accept, then we'd be even worse, which would still lead to hell. So basically, it didn't make that much difference. But once Baba has arrived and he says, hey, you know, your souls, you're mine, I'm yours, you know, forget all that garbage that you learned in your schools, universities, Lokic homes and schools and temples and all this. And I'm God, you know, and I'm your father and mother, and I know exactly how to raise you as fully, you know, balanced, harmonious people. And I'm the best teacher there is, because I know stuff and these other people don't know anything. And, you know, I am capable of making you into virtues-based people. So all you have to do is remember me and forget all that paramat, which is the same thing as saying forget ethics, values, and morality. But nobody knows except us. I'm trying to convince you. So do you see what I'm saying? Once Baba has arrived, we can afford to give up these Tamil Pradhan, man-made, questionable, toxic, conventional values, morals, and ethics, because we have Baba, because we have Srimad, because he's showing us. You see, Sri Baba gives us all the information, then he demonstrates it through Brahma Baba, and also through his selected Ananya children, the Dadis and this. And we have direct access. Anybody have indirect access to God? No, we have direct access. We have direct access to the Muralis. And he tells us, would you please churn this? Because if you churn it sufficiently, you get insights. And these insights, they actually change our mindset. Do you find that? And so, therefore, you know, it's an ongoing work, you see, because we are, unfortunately, and nobody realizes this, we are severely addicted to toxic, conventional morality, ethics, and values. That means we say we can give it up, we can't. It's very difficult to give it up because we're addicted. And addiction is characterized by denial. So there's a lot of denial about it. It's also characterized by, because you're in the company of moral, ethical people who are very, very sure that they're good, you see, and they will finger wag at you. You are Brahma Kumaris, brothers and sisters, bad. You know, Baba says, what's bad about brothers and sisters? You know, how about a little less, you know, raping and pillaging and all that? That'd be good, right? So, the only way that we can actually create a civilization which is 16 celestial degrees complete, complete with all the virtues, completely non-violent, you know, and all the rest of it, Maryada, Purushottam, and so on, is by giving up its opposite, which is the conventional toxic moralities. Does this make sense to you? Yes? Anybody object? Will this make any difference to how you conduct your Brahman life? That's the next question. Because I believe, hope, think that it should, could, will. You see. You know, one of the things we say in our normal conversation is, what should I do when I know that someone is doing something wrong? Have you had that question? You know, I see there's some senior person doing something wrong. What should I do? You know. Now it's actually quite strange that we should have this question, because Baba's told us exactly what to do. He said, well, you know, at the moment when a Maharati is body conscious, they have to be body conscious to do something wrong. You can't do something wrong if you're soul conscious, right? So at the moment when a Maharati is body conscious, then for that moment they're not a Maharati, you see. So then they're just soul, you know, like anybody else. And then what do you do when you see a soul performing some normal soul activity? Is you become a detached observer and you say, Va Baba. Is that right? Do you do that? That's what you have to do. Va Baba. Hey, did you see that scene? Oh yes, he says, Tom and Jerry. That's what we're supposed to do. Because, I'll tell you an interesting yukti that I use quite a lot. It's very good for survival as a BK. And that is to realize, which of course Baba has told us many times, we had to practice it, that you are the only person in any particular scene in drama. And all the rest is a kind of sphere that you can perceive through your sense organs, which is a kind of a spherical video in which you see various performances of different characters. And Baba made it quite clear in the Murali today that this is not a play, this is a film. And it's a 3D film. So you have all these holographic characters who are performing good, bad, or indifferent performances. But what is also going on is when you see that you're the only person in that situation, is Baba, with his grade book, is grading us. How is my student handling this situation? Is this student aware of the knowledge of drama? Tick. 10 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 2 out of 10, whatever, you know. Is this student soul conscious and being a detached observer? You get a grade for it. Does this student use the right power to receive the situation in a way that is profitable for the student? Are you taking profit from a situation which appears to be profitless? You know, are you using the power of transformation? You get a grade for it. Are you using the power of accommodation? You have to accommodate a lot. Yes, no, 1 out of 10, 10 out of 10, whatever, you see. And so we're in the school under continuous assessment, and at the end he will say, okay, well, here's your grade book. These are all the situations. He'll replay that. He's got really good video equipment. And he'll replay it to you and say, look, you know, I put you in this situation. You thoroughly failed. So you got a 0 for that one. I gave it to you again 15 times. By the 15th time, you slightly opened your eyes and noticed that you could handle it differently, so you got a grade for that. And, you know, by about the 250th time, perhaps you got it. Do we need to progress that slowly? We always like to progress more quickly, isn't it? So it's just all about helping each other to get it, what's going on here. But the major obstacle is that you are still wearing the glasses of conventional morality, ethics, and values, and seeing everything in those terms, which means you might as well be blind. So please remove these glasses, screw on your third eye tight, focus it, and see it as Baba has told us. What do you think? Is that good? Okay, so now I'm going to show you a video. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this video. I have been given a marvelous little playground called Godlywood Studio. So, it is possible for me to make TV shows about whatever I want to. And nobody stops me, so it's great. And so, I have made a series of 60 shows on lots of different topics to do with values, virtues, ethics, and morality. And I'm going to show you one of them now, and it is called Non-Conventional Values. So this is really what I'm interested in us individually and collectively creating to replace the conventional, toxic, Tamil Pradhan, old-style, iron-aged morality, so that we can start to operate from a different foundation, which is really based on Baba's knowledge, Baba's virtues, and Baba's way of looking at things. And if you want to see more of them, you will find them on my YouTube channel, which I will tell you about later. Okay, so I will just go down there and make the thing work. Om Shanti.
Ethics and Morality. My name is Magla Pillay, and I have in the studio with me today Sister Denise, who has been practicing Raj Yoga meditation for over 40 years. The subject that we are taking up today is non-conventional value system. The method of inquiry that we're going to be using is called the Socratic method, and that is a manner of putting questions to someone or group of individuals in order to elicit a truth that is understandable by all rational human beings. The purpose of today's show is to look at conventional values, to look at the way human beings think and function, and also to question the way people are and whether it works for us in today's world. Sister Denise, very warm welcome to today's show.
Thank you.
Could you tell us why this subject is of interest to you and how is it relevant to the times in which we find ourselves?
Well, we have the two. We have conventional value systems, and then what I'm interested in is the non-conventional value systems. So conventional value systems are the ones that we all grew up with, that everyone is familiar with, and they're based on the idea of the fundamental paradigm of materialism, which means that everyone is either a man or a woman. So conventional value systems, they have one set of values for males and a slightly different set of values that apply to females, which means that there's a fundamental inequity factored into the value system, so that when people are interested in equal pay for equal work, it is a problem because the value system mitigates against it. There are other areas of law, areas of different kind of rights, children, conjugal rights, all these type of things. It's different if you're a man or if you're a woman. Whereas non-conventional values would be values based on spirituality, which means that we are not either men or women. The bodies are, but the self who inhabits the body is a genderless person. And because of that, there is no foundation for making a differentiation based on gender in terms of values. That means that everybody is actually treated equally in terms of rights, in terms of responsibilities. Of course, there are differences in the roles, but there are areas of fundamental rights and also areas where you're looking at the actual value of a person. Whether you're in a male body or a female body, you are valuable because you are a person. And there are some cultures which honor that, but most cultures really make a big difference, which means that it's actually not possible to carry the idea of spiritual values very far because it gets blocked by the materialist paradigm. So non-conventional values also means that a person will think about themselves differently. They will not think, well, I'm a woman, therefore I'm of lower value, or I'm a man, therefore I'm of higher value. You see, that syllogism couldn't work. I'm a human being, and therefore I have value. That goes across the board.
Does that mean when you speak of conventional value system, is there need in humanity right now for a new value system to emerge? Because has the old one failed humanity?
Well, I think it has.
In what way?
Well, take another angle. Being of a particular religion doesn't automatically mean that the people of any other religion are of less value.
Okay.
But if you come from the angle that if you are of a particular religion, and if there's anybody who is of a different religion, then they are automatically of lower value, or it applies also where there is caste system, class differentiation, all of the differentiations based on creed, gender, color, all of these things is based in the materialist paradigm. And what spirituality says is that those differentiations are based on falsehood, because it's not true that the body color changes your value. It's not true that the gender changes your value. It's not true that the caste changes your value. You see what I'm saying? Your value is associated with your being, the soul. Now, you bring in the idea of karma. Every soul takes birth in better or less good circumstances, which reflects their karma. Those external material considerations don't really reflect a variation in value. What changes the value of a person is the quality of their action. So that, you know, if a person is doing less good action, anyway the laws of karma are going to come in and cause that person to have to pay in some way, and so the quality of their life will be reduced by that. But the way that we interact with another human being has to be based on the inner qualities rather than external, physical, visible, cultural, or other such considerations, you see. And nowadays, you have so much negative behavior towards people, including wars. You know, there are many wars, and people are getting killed and tortured and mutilated on the basis of their race or their religion or their political affiliation, you see. Now, everybody has a right to whatever those things are. It doesn't make you suitable to be damaged by somebody else who judges you to be unfit or you should be killed because of this or that. No. When a person performs antisocial action, that antisocial action creates an issue with the local law, but then even the laws themselves, they need to be equitable, not biased against minorities or biased against people because of their cultural or religious or ethnic identity.
Mm. So, Denise, you shared something very beautiful, that the value of an individual rests in their being and not in the external. Why is, what comes to mind is that that would be an antidote to almost every problem in the world. Why is that understood by so few, if it's such a universally applicable principle?
A number of reasons. One reason is you have to have power, inner power to understand it, inner spiritual power to understand it. Secondly, you have to go against the grain, which not everybody is able to do. Most people are not willing to do because it costs so much to go against the grain. And so I think that we're at a time where the current is changing direction. So that the current so far has been leading everybody down the path of materialism, which I feel has enhanced human suffering and confusion and difficulties. And now it seems to be turning, going the other way, towards the direction of spirituality. But I think there have to be something rather like what is called imaginal cells. Do you know about imaginal cells?
No.
In when a caterpillar spins a cocoon and sits in the cocoon, and then all of a sudden something happens. So what the biologists have found is that just before the butterfly has to happen, there are these little imaginal cells that create that image of the butterfly, and they cause it to happen very, very quickly. So I feel that this is quite a suitable analogy, that those of us who do naturally go against the conventional current and who have a substantial foundation of goodness for doing that, they in a way are acting like imaginal cells for a transformation that I feel is taking place in humanity. And it doesn't need very many to make that change, but the ones who do make that change, they have to be very clear, very strong, and their vision of where things are going is so clear in their minds that they just go, and then everyone else is drawn to that, in spite of reactions and resistance. You know, the current of materialism, extremism, and so on has reached a maximum, and the imaginal cell people are, you know, shifting it and making it go in the other direction. And I think it doesn't take many people to do this. They just have to be very clear, very strong in their sense of who they are, and that their vision of where to go is also very clear.
Mm. So, Denise, you use the expression materialistic paradigm often. What is your working definition of that?
Well, the materialistic paradigm means that everything that is matter is real, and anything that you can't see, touch, measure, you know, make contact with through your five senses, anything that doesn't fit there doesn't exist.
Mm.
Whereas the paradigm of spirituality says that there is matter, no doubt, and there is another dimension, which is the dimension of the spirit, which you cannot neglect, because the actual person who is performing action in the material world is a spiritual being, and there are laws of spirituality that govern everyone who's conscious. And the way in which they interact with each other, with matter, and also with the divine supreme being. And if you say that that dimension doesn't exist, then the kind of actions you do will lead you to something of a disaster. Because you're just not taking into consideration very important energies, powers, and realities.
You mentioned earlier that where people consider themselves to be male or female and are judged on all the things that the standards by which human beings judge others, and then taking it further to seeing the person from inside rather than external. I get the sense as you were speaking that the way humanity judges each other and categorizes people has caused them quite a bit of damage. Can we come back from that damage? Because it causes, it has hurt a lot of what you said, that has been true for so many people for such a long time, has caused so much of pain. And how does one come back from that? How does one recover from that to embrace what you just said?
Well, partly it's study. And you will study these ideas, you will study the concepts of spirituality when you find that the materialist concept or paradigm just doesn't work for you. It will trigger some sort of a search for something to replace it, because once something doesn't work for you, you need something that does work, and you will not stop until you find it. So then a lot of people are in search.
A lot of people may be searching, but they're searching for the wrong, in the wrong place, for the wrong things. And as a Denise, you'll find that a lot of people would want to embrace what you are saying, okay? But for example, I've heard once that if somebody has experienced a trauma, that trauma becomes part of their identity. Okay, now you are a non-conventional value system offers an alternative and a real identity as opposed to a false one. But we do hold on to our weaknesses, don't we? How do you let go of that and embrace something new?
The weaknesses hold on to us.
Oh, really?
So, you have a trauma that's holding you in a vice grip. It's putting you into survival mode, which means that you are getting more and more full of character defects. You're in pain, you're causing pain, you're in like the jail of this vice, which is what happens when you integrate a trauma into your life. And for you to come out of it means you have to go through the initial pain. And so for that, you have to have enormous personal power, because it's very painful to come out through the same way you went in.
Ouch.
Now, there may be a better way to do it, but in my experience, that is a way that I know works, and I haven't really come across an easier way.
It takes, obviously, courage to face that.
Well, courage is a good virtue, and the power to face is one of the powers that comes to you when you meditate. So the whole thing is a matter of accumulation, and then you get insights along the way. And as the right moment comes, where you've got enough courage, enough insight, and it's, okay, today I'll do it. And then you move. You might not move very far, but you do move some little way, and it may be incremental, but you're on your way. And that, I think, is the key.
If somebody embraces what you just said, because it sounds so incredibly beautiful and so healing, it's the feeling that I get from what you're saying is it's almost like therapy, because it brings a sense of healing to be liberated from your own personal prison, as it were. It requires a lot of self-work to establish a new spiritual identity, doesn't it? Because the old identity of thinking, not even being arrogant, not even I'm my job, but I'm female, is so deep-seated. Is so deep-seated that when you're, for example, say if you find yourself in a swimming pool drowning, then you would fight to save your life because this is what you think you are. My question is, what level of effort does one require to establish this new identity, to establish a non-conventional value system and let go of the old one?
The old one is a shell, a mask, which you became fused with. And so you become confused, and you have to practice what we call bodilessness. When you practice to be bodiless, you can actually separate yourself from this mask that you fused with, which became your substitute identity. And once that happens, it's able to fall away. Because you become clear that it's a mask, it's not me. And it's done its duty. Almost like when a house is getting built, there's scaffolding to, you know, enable the different workers to work on the different parts of the house, but then when it's ready, then you take down the scaffolding. So in the same way, you are on the inside recreating your original being. The scaffolding that is there, that's necessary while you're building the inner beautiful home, the identity, that scaffolding, after a while, it has to be taken down because it's no longer relevant and is ugly, you see. So a friend of mine was working on themselves in this, and what she said is she experienced disgust with that false identity, and that disgust was a very important trigger mechanism to drop the false mask, because it was disgusting.
That motivation.
And also, she said, you cannot, fault anyone else for putting you in that spot. You put yourself in that spot. And when you're disgusted with your own self for doing what is not good for you, that can make you stop doing it.
This obviously requires a lot of internal work. What about your life on the outside By that I mean, if you're doing all of this internal work of re-establishing your identity and embracing non-conventional values, what happens to your relationships with other people, your relationship with your body, your responsibilities? Because you're going through some massive shift, and your life outside can't possibly stay the same?
No, it does shift. I think it's very good to have these inner changes, and of course it disturbs the outside, and it may take a little while before you settle into a new sense of identity that is the right thing, that corresponds with who you are. But when you're in the state of becoming, it may not be comfortable, it may not look very good, but you have to be patient and trusting. Trust the process and take yourself through, and you find that, yes, it starts to reform itself in a way that corresponds much better to the real person that you are.
Sister Denise, one would find that when you're changing internally, embracing non-conventional values internally, then on the outside, there can be certain behavioral patterns that are difficult to change. For example, if one has an addiction to something or someone, and then now on listening to your inspiring talk, somebody now decides to relook at themselves, the soul, and yet there's a conflict of behavior outside. How does one...
It wouldn't work like that.
How would it work?
If you have an addiction, that addiction is going to take you to a very uncomfortable point in your life, which will be the trigger for the change. So you won't figure out that you've got an addiction after you've been changing. The addiction and the way that it fails you so completely is the trigger to really relook at your life.
Mm.
So in that sense, it works the other way around.
Mm. It's now become very common to hear of people in your immediate space who have a whole number of mental afflictions that was unheard of 20 years ago. Like, I know a lot of people who are bipolar. I know a lot of adults who have ADHD, adults, not children. These are actual medical problems, not the mental kind. How does one embrace what you said if faced with that level of challenge?
I think that we have to look at also the fact that in earlier times there was a very extreme prejudice against anyone with mental illness. So anybody who has some discomfort internally in their mind, they will hide it. They will do everything to hide it because they will not want to be classified as somebody who's mentally ill, because that's worse than being criminal. So now it's the prejudice against mental illness has shifted. And it's now just part of the continuum of ailments. And you can go for therapy, it's quite acceptable. And then you learn things and you maybe take medication and so on and so forth to alleviate that difficulty. But to recover with or without drugs, psychotropic drugs, from a mental illness is a big journey and a lot of work, and in a way you need to be very strong to do that. So meditation can be helpful, but on the other hand, depending on the nature of the problem, meditation can even make it worse, because you become too disconnected from the reality. So because meditation does take you to a detached state, but if you're already disconnected, then meditation is not a useful thing to do. You have to get connected and then detach. So,
connected to what and detached from what?
Connected to the material world and all the responsibilities and realities of the material world, and then to become detached, but not dissociated. You see, a lot of people, they think dissociation and detachment is the same thing, but not at all.
Denise, the paradox that I'm picking up is you saying that in order to do this, you need to be very strong. In order to do this, you're very strong. What if your primary weakness is the fact that you're a weak person? And so how do you do this then?
Anyway, everyone is running on empty, spiritually depleted. But you may have a capacity that is greater than someone else's. So once you start filling through meditation, maybe you just keep filling, 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 and you find that your capacity to fill is very large. And that indicates that you are a very strong person. But when you're empty, spiritually empty, you may not even realize it until you start to fill. There are people who fill but only to a limited amount, and so they only go to that far. And everyone is different, you know.
Okay. Well, Sister Denise, I think that brings us to the end of today's show. Non-conventional values, ladies and gentlemen, a very interesting subject and not something that you hear every day. And as you see, Sister Denise has shared with us as to how applicable and necessary it has become to embrace this way of thinking. I hope that what you heard today is something that you can put into your life, and I do hope that it works for you. Sister Denise, thank you very much for an extremely informative half an hour, and we will see all of you again soon. Thank you, and goodbye.
Om Shanti. Was that interesting? Useful? There's lots more where that came from. What I think would be nice now is to have a half an hour break. Would you like that? And when you come back, I'm going to ask you to do some writing work. So if you make sure you've got your pencil and notebook. And so I'd like to see you in 11:30 back here, okay? All right. Om Shanti.